The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's G-S-U-G-G-S insurance.com. Or call 919-875-8888. Today there is no new edition of Time Magazine that has been published for this week, so I will be reading from previous issues. The first being the most recent, August 31/September 7, 2020. I am in fact recording this on September 7, 2020, and this is the cover by Nika Jones. It's a photograph of a partially embroidered U.S. flag. Down at the bottom, where the embroidery hasn't been completed, on one of the red stripes is a needle tucked into the handiwork. At least the first three articles you hear will be from this issue. If I move to another issue, I will be sure to announce that. Beginning with The Nation, Undeliverable. This white headline appears on a bright red background with additional bright red, blue, white, and yellow graphics. The white and yellow are squares and rectangles flying from the back of a USPS, a United States Postal Service truck. It's emblazoned with the modernistic-looking eagle in white on a bright blue background. It has horizontal stripes in bright red and bright blue. The tires on this truck are bright blue. There are the mirrors, the large mirrors for the driver to see in various directions where she or he is going. And at the wheel looks predominantly a silhouette of perhaps President Trump. And again, Undeliverable, by embroiling the Postal Service in controversy and shaking Americans' confidence in mail voting, the president wins. By Haley Sweetland Edwards and Abby Vesoulis. This illustration is by Ben Wiseman for Time. At home in Kentucky in mid-August, Mitch McConnell did not sound the slightest bit concerned. "The Postal Service is going to be just fine," the Senate Majority Leader drawled, echoing the soothing talking points of other Republicans. The Trump administration was just reforming a 228-year-old institution, and President Donald Trump's new Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, was making it more efficient. The same day, Trump described the situation in his own half-joking way. "I want to make the post office great again, okay?" But the lighthearted talk just highlighted the spreading national panic that had triggered it. Less than 80 days before a presidential election that will rely more heavily on voting by mail than any previous race in U.S. history, the great machinery of the U.S. Postal Service, USPS, seemed to be sputtering to a halt. The operational pivot DeJoy announced in July, which included restrictions on staff overtime and transportation costs, produced a backlog of undelivered mail, according to postal union representatives. The Department of Veterans Affairs acknowledged prescription drugs mailed to veterans via USPS had been delayed by an average of almost 25% over the past year. Small businesses, which rely on the affordability of USPS rates, began facing angry customers whose packages were lost in distribution centers for weeks. At the end of July, the Postal Service itself sounded the alarm, sending warning letters to 46 states, including the electoral battlegrounds of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Florida, alerting them that the USPS might not be able to meet their election deadlines. In all, more than 159 million registered voters live in the 40 states that received the most urgent warnings, according to the Washington Post. Panicked constituents papered the door of DeJoy's D.C. apartment building with fake ballots reading, "Save the Post Office, Save Our Democracy." House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called lawmakers back for an emergency session to vote on a bill to protect the USPS. And Democratic Senator Gary Peters launched an investigation into DeJoy's operational changes. "It is a level of concern I have not seen in the past," said Melissa Rakestraw, a mail carrier in Illinois. DeJoy, who spent more than three decades running New Breed Logistics, a national supply chain services provider with 7,000 employees, seemed blindsided by the fallout. The Postal Service has lost money for years, thanks to the rise of the Internet, perennial mismanagement, and heavy-handed but ineffective government interventions. The point of his reform agenda, which included reassigning or displacing 23 veteran postal executives, was to cut costs and increase performance for the election and upcoming peak season, he wrote in an internal memo obtained by CNN. The slowdowns and backlogs, he said, were unintended consequences. But outsiders spotted a pattern. Behind the daily chaos, Trump's presidency has one abiding characteristic: using the vast power and reach of the U.S. government to serve Trump's own political ends. He has repeatedly explained executive actions by pointing to the political benefit they bring him, and a steady parade of his top advisors have offered detailed examples after leaving the administration in exasperation. Trump tried to turn the Department of Homeland Security into a tool used for his political benefit, said the agency's former chief of staff, by, for example, ordering officials to close stretches of the border in Democratic-led California rather than GOP-led Arizona and Texas. The president pleaded with the leader of China to make trade decisions that would bolster Trump's relationship with crucial farm state voters ahead of the 2020 election, according to former National Security Advisor John Bolton. And, of course, Trump was impeached 8 months ago, in part for allegedly withholding military aid from Ukraine until the country investigated Trump's political rivals. The list goes on. If there were any doubts about the administration's motives for the so-called reform of the Postal Service, the president himself seemed to put them to rest. In an August 13 interview with Fox Business, the president said he was blocking Democrats' proposed $25 billion for the USPS and $3.5 billion for additional election resources, because that outlay would help the Postal Service handle a surge in mail voting this year. "They need that money in order to make the post office work, so it can take all of these millions and millions of ballots," Trump said. "Now, if we don't make a deal, that means they don't get the money. That means they cannot have universal mail-in voting. They just can't have it." Less than a week later, DeJoy announced the suspension of much of his reform agenda until after the election, to avoid even the appearance of any impact on election mail. But the damage may already have been done. Whatever happens to the USPS in coming months, Trump benefits from having cast doubt on the USPS and mail voting, and from having unleashed a specter of impropriety over the core exercise of democracy. When Americans lose faith in the electoral process, voter turnout slumps. And if Trump supporters do not believe their votes were fairly counted, they are less likely to accept an outcome in which he does not win. Most Americans love the Postal Service and rely on it, regardless of their politics. More than 90% view the agency favorably, according to a 2020 Pew Research Center poll. George Washington himself saw a national postal network as an amplifier of democratic ideals, and that egalitarianism continues today. FedEx and UPS pin a premium on letters destined thousands of miles away, while a letter mailed by USPS anywhere within the country costs just 55 cents. But as the post office has faced new challenges over the years, lawmakers of both parties have advocated for reform. In 1970, after more than 150,000 postal workers went on strike, halting the delivery of vital mail, the Democratic-led Congress oversaw a reorganization of the USPS, demoting the Postmaster General from the cabinet, and crucially, cutting off taxpayer support. The Postal Service as we know it today funds itself from its own sales. With the rise of the Internet, those sales have plummeted. In 2001, the USPS moved more than 103.7 billion pieces of first-class mail. In 2019, the number was almost half that, at 55 billion. Rising fuel prices and trucking costs and an uptick in the number of packages have exacerbated the problem. In 2006, Congress again went after the Postal Service, this time passing a bipartisan bill. It was approved by unanimous consent in the Senate, mandating that the USPS pre-fund health benefits for its retirees and invest those funds in government bonds, which offer dismal returns. It is a requirement that no other entity, public or private, must meet, and it costs the USPS more than $5 billion per year, roughly 7% of its total operating costs. The requirement is responsible for a large portion of the agency's annual shortfall, according to its financial reports. Last year, USPS tallied $79.9 billion in expenditures and finished the year with $11 billion in outstanding debt. The parties have long been divided over how to fix these deficits. For decades, Democrats accused Republicans of sabotaging the Postal Service in an effort to privatize it. Republicans denied the charge and defended their reform efforts by pointing, not incorrectly, at the USPS's hemorrhaging balance sheets. But then came the Trump administration, with its tendency to say the quiet part out loud. In 2018, the White House suggested for the USPS a future conversion from a government agency into a privately held corporation. Over the past 5 months, this relatively obscure policy fight was transformed into a democracy-defining battle. In April, the USPS asked Congress for $75 billion to help it weather the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. When stores shuttered, the Postal Service saw first-class mail, its most profitable product, decline, while the volumes of packages, the most labor-intensive to deliver, surged, as Americans increasingly shopped online. Democrats are pushing for more USPS funding in their latest relief bill, but the White House has so far resisted. In late July, the Treasury Department authorized the agency to borrow up to $10 billion under strict conditions. In May, DeJoy's appointment to the top postal job seemed to confirm Democrats' worst fears that what had been an ideological push to privatize the postal service had morphed into an effort to swing the election for Trump. DeJoy has deliberately enacted policies to sabotage the postal service to serve only one person, President Trump, said Representative Gerald Connolly of Virginia, whose House subcommittee oversees the USPS. Democratic lawmakers had no say in the appointment of DeJoy, who donated more than $1.1 million to the Trump Victory Campaign Fund from August 2016 to February 2020. Under normal circumstances, the USPS's Board of Governors, which appoints the Postmaster General, is bipartisan. Presidents name each of the 9 Senate-confirmed members to 7-year terms. But Senate Republicans blocked Obama's nominees, allowing Trump to inherit an empty board, which he happily filled with like minds. Unable to prevent DeJoy's rise, congressional Democrats helplessly pointed at his apparent conflicts of interest. At the time he was appointed Postmaster General, the GOP megadonor held at least $30 million worth of stock in a supply chain company that contracts with the USPS, raising questions of whether he is violating ethics rules that prevent officials from participating in government matters affecting their personal finances. DeJoy also holds stock options that allow him to purchase Amazon shares at a below-market rate. As Amazon increases the proportion of packages it delivers itself and toys with the idea of delivering non-Amazon parcels too, the retail giant is quickly becoming a direct USPS competitor. DeJoy's announcement on August 18 that he would suspend much of his reform agenda until after the election may seem like a win for Democrats. In the coming weeks, DeJoy will be hauled in front of both House and Senate for hearings, and a congressional investigation into this summer's events is ongoing. But the politics are not so simple. DeJoy's reversal left a host of unanswered questions. What would happen to the dozens of mail sorting machines and drop boxes that have already been hauled off? When will workers' overtime be approved? Will postal workers be able to take more than one trip per day? Will states have to buy more expensive postage to circumvent delays? Without proactive moves to safeguard mail delivery, hundreds of thousands of ballots may still end up in the trash. In 32 states, ballots must arrive by election day, according to an analysis by the National Conference of State Legislatures. During this year's primaries, at least 65,000 mailed ballots were discarded for various reasons, according to NPR. While that represents only about 1% of the ballots in most states, according to the NPR analysts, tiny margins matter. In 2016, Trump won Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, each by margins of less than 1%, but that was enough to claim 46 electoral votes and the presidency. The best-case scenario for the agency is that Congress gives it emergency funding. Public scrutiny persists, and DeJoy makes good on his promise to deliver the nation's election mail on time. But that cannot undo what has been done. By discrediting the Postal Service and mail voting, Trump has already tainted the election results, whatever they may be. According to an Axios Ipsos poll in August, 47% of voters supporting Vice President Joe Biden said they plan to vote by mail, compared with just 11% of Trump supporters. If that disparity holds true in November, the fallout could be bad for both parties. Older and rural voters, who have in the past relied on mail ballots and tend to support Republicans, may be discouraged from voting at all. Trump could also appear to be ahead on election night among in-person voters, only to be overtaken as disproportionately Democratic mailed ballots are slowly counted days and weeks later. It is not hard to imagine the damage that a hung election, like the 2000 Bush-Gore debacle, could exact in the era of Trump-fueled disinformation. Democracy, after all, is not unlike flying in Peter Pan's world. If you stop believing in it, it ceases to work. Battlefield Chicago. This is under the Nation caption. In a city's fight against gun violence, do federal agents help or hurt? By W.J. Hennigan, Dateline, Chicago. There's a photo on this page. Actually, it covers two pages. Skyscrapers in the background, the skyscrapers of Chicago, against a bluish-pinkish sky. So perhaps it's dawn or dusk. There are some streetlights in the background. In the foreground is a Chicago police vehicle with about six men standing in a cluster wearing vests, some of which say police on the back, with other men dressed in khaki and black standing more in the background. They are not identifiable by any indicia on their clothing. The caption reads, "An unrelenting wave of deadly shootings has hit Chicago this summer amid the pandemic." And this photograph that I tried to describe was by John J. Kim. The trouble began, as too often it does in Chicago, with a gun. On a humid afternoon on August 9, a woman called 911 to report that a man in a red hat and shirt was starting a fight at Moran Park in Englewood, a predominantly black neighborhood on Chicago's south side. There were children playing nearby, she warned, and he had a gun. At 2:38 p.m., four Chicago police officers in an unmarked Ford SUV rolled past the park, where they spotted a man matching the caller's description. When they flipped on their lights, he ran. The chase led down an alley, where the suspect fired at least eight shots at two officers sprinting after him, according to prosecutors. The cops returned fire. The suspect fell to the ground, then stood back up and disappeared into an abandoned lot. As the officers hunted for him, the radios clipped to their bulletproof vests crackled to life. A gunshot victim needed help at a house nearby. The police headed to a powder blue bungalow where they saw a trail of blood leading from the foot of the front door through the house down to the basement. There, police say, they found the suspect, blood seeping from wounds in his cheek and abdomen. The man, later identified as 20-year-old Latrell Allen, was taken into custody and sent to a hospital for treatment. It did not take long for news of the shooting to circulate as yet another example of racial injustice at the hands of police. Tempers flared, particularly in the South Side and West Side communities, where a legacy of segregation, police discrimination, failed schools, and misguided public housing policy have thwarted advancement of black families for generations. That night, for more than 3 hours, hundreds of looters smashed windows and carried away armfuls of jewelry, clothes, and electronics from retail stores, first on the south side, then farther north, into downtown shopping districts, including the city's Magnificent Mile. When the sun rose Monday, August 10, shattered glass carpeted sidewalks, trash billowed down major streets, and police stood guard in riot gear on corners. In an interview the next day with Time, Mayor Lori Lightfoot laid the blame for the chaos not on protesters, but on organized criminal operatives taking advantage of an emotional moment to strike. It was a planned attack, the mayor declared. The cryptic allegation was lent credence by the person making it. Elected in 2019 as the first black woman and openly gay person to serve as Chicago's mayor, Lightfoot has a history of independence and a balanced background in criminal justice, having served as a federal prosecutor and led two bodies that police the city's law enforcement. Where some saw mindless violence, she observed elements of preparation. With U-Haul trucks and cargo vans and sophisticated equipment used to cut metal. Riots may look alike, especially from a distance, but locals close to the ground, including mayors, are in position to tell the difference between damage done by a protest that has spun out of control and by those simply using social unrest as cover for personal gain. As he seeks re-election as a law and order candidate, Trump has seized upon violent crime in Democrat-led cities as a problem only he and the federal government can fix. On July 22, he expanded Operation Legend, the plan to surge hundreds of federal agents into U.S. cities, experiencing what he called a shocking explosion of shootings, killings, murders, and heinous crimes of violence. After decades of declining crime, cities across the U.S. are experiencing a spike in shootings and homicides this summer. No city's been hit worse than Chicago. In July alone, 565 people were shot, at least 63 of them juveniles. But while Operation Legend, which has deployed agents from the FBI, DEA, and Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, ATF, in 9 cities, offers critical expertise to solve crimes, it is irrelevant to the deeper systemic issues that contribute to the violence, such as poverty, underfunded public schools, and structural racism. These matters may be of secondary importance to a president running for re-election who's brazenly attempting to stoke fears of suburban voters by associating race with violence. If tamping down violence were a policing problem, it would have been solved decades ago in Chicago, says Else Redmond, 56, a community organizer from the South Side's Bronzeville neighborhood. We do not need more cops. We need better cops. That leaves officials like Lightfoot where they were before Trump waded in, looking for real solutions. She recognizes the city is at an inflection point brought on by the pandemic, the ensuing economic paralysis, and the widening gulf of suspicion between the black community and her police force. The question is, how do we find opportunity out of even these very dark days, Lightfoot asks. And what do we do to band together? Because it sounded cliched, but it's so true. We will not survive this moment. We will not thrive. We will not move beyond, get stronger and better, if we do not unite. Every time somebody's murdered in Chicago, O.G. Eggleston's Android phone vibrates with a text. As executive director with Chicago Survivors, a nonprofit that provides services to the families of homicide victims in the city, he gets a message generated by a Chicago police reporting system that alerts him to another grieving family. I received the name, gender, age, and location of every single homicide victim, he says. They come at all hours of the day, nearly every day. Eggleston's organization guides each family through the complicated processes that go with caring for a dead loved one. What to do at the medical examiner's office, what to ask at the funeral parlor, and how to pay for it all. But it's the city's cycle of violence that drives the need for Chicago Survivors. When families are grieving and they do not receive the necessary resources in a timely manner, that grief can turn to anger, and that anger can turn to retaliation, Eggleston says. So that's where we look to provide the violence interruption. No challenge has proved more vexing to Lightfoot during her first full year in office than stopping this grim tide. The 443 homicides recorded in Chicago through July were a 53% increase over a year earlier. New York City, with three times the population, had just 244 murders. It is difficult to find a corner in Chicago's south and west sides not in some way affected by gang violence. Police say there are 117,000 gang members across the city, which counts 55 known gangs. Officers in Chicago routinely confiscate more illegal guns than those in New York City and Los Angeles combined. Now, during the pandemic, gun sales are hitting record highs across the country. FBI background checks, a proxy to track sales, have surged. Chicago has no gun shops in the city and no background check loopholes for private sales. And yet, so far this year, Chicago police have seized more than 6,400 guns, a pace set to match the 10,000 confiscated last year. A 2017 study found some 60% of guns used in crimes come from states like Wisconsin, Mississippi, and Indiana. They have very different sensibilities about guns than we do here in Chicago, Lightfoot says. You can literally drive over the border into Indiana and get military-grade weapons in any quantity your money will buy, and they bring them back to Chicago. The 4th of July weekend in Chicago was particularly gruesome. There were 87 people shot across the city. Among the 17 people killed was Tyrone Long, 33. He was outside with friends when a man riding in a blue SUV opened fire. Shot several times in the chest, he died at a nearby hospital. It wasn't like you just died or got hit by a bus, says Linda Long, his mother. Someone took his life, and it really hurts my soul that my son is not here. Tyrone, named Boomer by his father, was the second oldest of Linda's four boys. He was a cook, just like her, and the father of an 8-year-old daughter, Zuri. He volunteered time at his aunt's anti-violence organization, Sacred Ground Ministries, where he counseled young people about the risks of getting involved in gangs and drugs. His cousin, Eric Williams, 25, was killed by gun violence in 2012. Detectives have not called for weeks about Tyrone's murder. No one has ever got caught for my nephew's death, and it ain't looking good on finding Tyrone's killer, Linda says. Nobody's listening. When are they going to listen? When are they going to hear us crying out for help? When? To say the Chicago Police Department, CPD, has a trust problem in black neighborhoods is a gross understatement. The department's long troubled history with communities of color spans generations. For decades, long before George Floyd's death, waves of demonstrations routinely choked city streets, to denounce an institution seen as more akin to an occupying force than committed public servants. A 2017 Department of Justice DOJ investigation found officers in the city had acted with a pattern and practice of excessive force, disproportionately targeting people of color in stops, searches, arrests, and shootings, including the notorious 2014 killing of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. In 2019, the DOJ and the city agreed to police reform agreements enforced by a judge, known as a consent decree that would address civil rights abuses the probe brought to light. 1 year after being elected, Lightfoot hired as superintendent the former Dallas police chief, David Brown, renowned for his earnest efforts to bridge the gap between cops and communities of color. I'm going to go back to what I believe has been the most promising aspect of policing in the last 20 years, community-oriented policing, Brown says. We are all safer when we work together, when we trust each other, when the relationship is strong. Even when we have mistakes made by police, we should not let our missteps or past indiscretions prevent us from moving forward together. That takes an investment of his officers' time inside neighborhoods, going block by block, meeting people and building trust, Brown says. The city increased the number of cops on the street, spent more than $7 million to expand local organizations' anti-violence outreach, and launched a new 300-officer unit to participate with community relations programs, including food drives and church gatherings. The head of Chicago's police union initially celebrated Trump's approach of sending additional federal officers, but community activists ask how a couple hundred agents from out of town can meaningfully augment a police force of 13,000, the nation's second largest. The false pretense here is that we can inject a number of people from three-letter agencies and that's going to fix all the problems, says Ed Yonka, spokesman for the ACLU of Illinois. That kind of thinking has never really gotten anywhere, and in fact has driven further wedges between the police and communities. Lightfoot agrees, recalling the chaos federal agents provoked in Portland, Oregon. As additional agents from the FBI, DEA, and ATF began arriving in Chicago, Lightfoot detected more national politics than local impact. A lot of rhetoric and hype, she said, adding, the jury's out as to whether or not they're actually going to be helpful. On July 27, ATF agents in Chicago popped the trunk of a Midnight Blue 2015 Dodge Charger and found seven handguns lying inside. According to court documents, the guns belonged to Benjamin Cortez Gomez, 27, a convicted felon nicknamed Benny Blanco. Agents had tracked Cortez Gomez after he allegedly purchased the weapons in the Indianapolis area and brought them into Chicago for resale. Now he had been arrested, and his guns sat on a gray countertop inside a modified tractor trailer parked outside a police facility on Chicago's west side. The $1.3 million mobile crime lab and the personnel who came with it are part of Trump's Operation Legend. ATF technician Jill Jacobson selects a black Glock pistol, carefully loads it with 9mm ammunition, and inserts the gun's muzzle into a red metal tank called a snail trap. She squeezes the trigger, a muffled pop, then another. Jacobson collects the two spent cartridges and walks them to a workstation on the other end of the air-conditioned trailer. A colleague briefly studies the cartridges under a microscope, then uploads their images into a national database. The firing pin and explosion inside each gun leave behind tiny markings, like fingerprints, which can be matched to previous crimes. There are no hits on these guns, which Kristen DeTaneo, ATF's special agent in charge in Chicago, takes as good news. They were taken off the street before a crime took place, she says. That is our goal. It is not unusual for federal agents to be working alongside local police in U.S. cities. DEA agents routinely play a role on drug trafficking cases and ATF agents in gun cases. What is unusual is the politics. Trump and his administration talk about Operation Legend as a way to repair Democrat-led cities. That leads mayors like Lightfoot to question whether the goal is to help local law enforcement or help Trump get reelected. Operation Legend takes its name from Legend Taliaferro, a four-year-old boy shot and killed as he slept at his home in Kansas City, Missouri, at the end of June. It has thus far expanded to Chicago, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Cleveland, Detroit, Indianapolis, Milwaukee, Memphis, and St. Louis. The decision to add a city to the list is ultimately signed off on by Attorney General William Barr. U.S. Attorney John Lausch of the Northern District of Illinois says bringing in agents to work closely with local police provides critical help on stopping and deterring crime from taking place. Prosecutors at the federal level are capable of pursuing charges that carry stiffer penalties than at the county level. For instance, unlawful possession of a firearm by a felon, one of the charges Cortez Gomez faces for allegedly having seven guns in his trunk, is punishable by up to 10 years in federal prison. Additionally, convicts must serve at least 85% of their sentence, which can be in a prison located in a state on the other side of the country. In the federal system, we have very strong sentences for violent crimes, and that helps us get further information from these offenders. Criminals know that, Barr said at an August 19 press conference, adding that Operation Legend had netted 1,485 arrests thus far. Our work is just getting started. And yet, even though Lausch's office has prosecuted more gun crimes each year for the past 3 years, gun violence continues to rise. Community activists, organizers, and civil rights groups worry that the arrival of feds is not making things better. The agents are not subject to the same level of oversight as local police on matters like use of force and body cameras. Not long after the Operation Legend announcement, hundreds of protesters gathered for a rally near where ATF agents set up their trailer. For several days, protesters assemble outside, calling for a decrease in the $1.6 billion CPD budget and for the money to be invested instead in long-neglected communities. Operation Legend sparked protests in Albuquerque. Mayors in several cities say they have serious reservations about its impact and intent. Quinton Lucas, mayor of Kansas City, where the program first rolled out, thought Trump purposefully muddled the use of federal forces in Portland and the deployment of agents under Operation Legend to protect to project authority during instability. It is a culture war, Lucas says. It is about cities and cities being out of control. And Trump's going to have something that helps, whether it helps or not. And we are pawns in this game. Chicago's problems are stubborn and speak to the tension at the heart of public safety as officials across the country address questions of race and policing. Lightfoot came into office intent on providing more opportunities to neighborhoods of color, which activists say know best how to prevent violence. But the mayor's been frustrated by the criminal activity already taking place. To see young people who are black act in the way they acted, like they had every right to take somebody else's property, and not just the big guys who have lots of insurance, but the little shop owners in neighborhoods all across the city. They have so little respect for all the sacrifice that people who look like them put into forming a business, all their hurdles, all their challenges that small businesses have, Lightfoot says, particularly small businesses of color, without any regard for not only hurting those business owners, but hurting also employees who also are generally employees of color. That offends me to the core. And by its nature, the drama of crime overwhelms all else, including the straits that confine many of the city's poor. In June, the city's unemployment rate was 15.6%, significantly higher than the national rate, but higher still outside wealthy North Side neighborhoods, where single-digit jobless rates skew the citywide figure, analysts say. Severe poverty, insecurity, and childhood hunger are geographically concentrated in the West and South Sides. Many black families who have given up hope or managed to pull themselves out of poverty have moved away. In 2019, for the fourth year in a row, Chicago saw its population decline. Nearly 50,000 black residents have left over the past 5 years. There are parts of our city that have not financially recovered since the 2008 recession, says Liz Dozier, a former high school principal who runs Chicago Beyond, a nonprofit that seeks to alleviate economic pressures within low-income communities. The pandemic has just devastated communities even more. Chicago Beyond has invested more than $30 million in organizations that target at-risk youth and young adults. Since the onset of the pandemic, Chicago Beyond has been running weekly food drives across the city. But quarantines and lockdowns have restricted access to churches, schools, and community centers. Dozier argues that with its hard-working ethos and multiculturalism, Chicago still qualifies as a microcosm of America. Its problems may be deep-seated, she says, but they are the problems of the country that the country must confront if we are to move forward. And the starting point in any discussion is the question of security for everyone. Despite economic and racial disparities, the city's interconnected in ways that are not always apparent. On Jewelers Row along Wabash Avenue in Chicago's Central Business District, some small business owners saw their entire livelihood wiped away in this month's mass looting. Mohammed Ashik, the 60-year-old owner of Watch Clinic, entered his watch repair shop to discover that all his inventory, some $900,000 worth, had been stolen from his glass showcases. Hundreds of watches for sale, and those he was fixing for customers were missing. None of it was insured. "It's my entire life," he says, as a nearby L train rumbles above his store. 42 years in this business. I'm left with nothing but my health." His fate had been decided less than 24 hours earlier, less than 10 miles away, when a Chicagoan spotted a man with a gun. A photo that accompanies this article is of Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot. With less than 2 years in office, she faces a surge of gun violence. Lightfoot is seated at a brown wood desk. One elbow is perched on the desk. Her hands are clasped in front of her. She's wearing a very dark-colored jacket. We see only the top of her. It's either dark gray or black or very dark blue over a blue and white striped shirt. She has graying hair. It's rather spiky in a short cut. She has brown skin, brown eyes, very faintly tinted lips, and wearing pearl earrings. An essay on activism. This page features Angela Davis and Yara Shahidi on empowering young people in their activism. And this may be abridged for time constraints. Actor and activist Yara Shahidi was born in 2000, 3 decades after Angela Davis began wielding her platform as a UCLA professor for radical activism. But their generational gap has not stopped them from becoming friends or uniting their efforts to dismantle white supremacy. The pair reconvened on Zoom to discuss the global nature of their struggle and the value of voting, regardless of ideology. Yara Shahidi, many people are talking about how unprecedented what we're going through is, when in reality there have been generations of precedents set. What is the importance of opening the conversation to involve many generations? Angela Davis. It is an extraordinary moment, and when conjunctures like this happen, they happen almost serendipitously. But if we have been doing the organizing work over the decades, then we can seize the moment. At the same time, I think we are reformulating questions and addressing issues in ways that ought to have happened in the immediate aftermath of slavery. We are doing today what should have been started 150 years ago. The focus has largely been on black people. I'm glad about this, but we should also acknowledge how essential it is to understand racism against indigenous people and what you might call the unholy alliance of colonialism and slavery-produced racist state violence, so that when we examine all the complex ways in which anti-black racism expresses itself in this country, we also should look at anti-indigenous and anti-Latinx state violence. YS. James Baldwin talked about how one of the greatest sins of white supremacy was taking away our global language and our ability to communicate with one another, making it harder to actively disassemble these common evils and racisms. It feels like I and some of my peers have received great benefit from being in direct connection with one another on social media. At the same time, social media has also the tendency to allow us to disappear things such as trends pop up and then fade. Something I'm trying to figure out is how we maintain consistent touch points and sustain conversations. A.D. Social media is very important. My experience as an organizer involves knocking on people's doors. When H. Rapp Brown was in jail, we raised $100,000 for his bail by going door to door in Los Angeles, largely in South Central, asking people to donate coins. That sounds prehistoric at this point. But I think it is important to use the technology as opposed to allowing the technology to use us. As a friend of mine pointed out years ago, how many likes you have is not necessarily an indication of the organizing work you have done. YS. Being a part of the social media world is often how one develops a political opinion. Do you have guidance for young people on how to develop a non-reactionary politic? AD. It is so important to not confuse information with knowledge. We all walk around with cell phones that give us access to a vast amount of information, but that does not mean, as a result, that we're educated. Education relies precisely on learning the capacity to formulate questions, critical thinking. Learning how to raise questions not only about the most complicated issues, but about the seemingly simplest issues. This is one of the reasons I find the trans movement so important. When one learns how to question the validity of the binary notion of gender, one is questioning that which has persistently been the most normal context of people's lives. The work of ideology happens in those seemingly normal places. This is also why the prison police abolition campaign has been so important. Prisons and the police state are assumed to have been with us forever. So we begin to ask how we address issues of harm without replicating the violence, how we create safety by not resorting to the same tools of violence that are responsible for us being unsafe. Y.S. I love the wording of questioning the most simple. This summer, I was going through an African philosophy canon, and what it highlighted for me is these Eurocentric or U.S.-centric norms that have been established. For readers who are submersed in Western media, are there other texts we should be turning to subvert these norms? A.D. I am reading this book now that's on my desk, Françoise Vergès, A Decolonial Feminism. Speaking of which, I know you're passionate about feminism. I am interested in how that passion is expressed in the social justice work you have been doing over the last period. That article was abbreviated because we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.